Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's fiction podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. This month we feature a dramatization of a story by British writer Marilyn Todd, whose best-known mystery series stars Claudia Sepharius, a widowed wine merchant trying to ply her trade in a man's profession in ancient Rome. The beautiful and irreverent Claudia has appeared in a number of stories for EQMM. Here she is in Cupid's Arrow from our September-October issue of 2003.
Let me see if I've got this right.
Claudia stopped pacing and ticked off the points on her fingers.
In 6 days, we, as producers and merchants of fine wines, celebrate the most important wine festival in Rome, when no lesser light than the priest of Jupiter himself will pronounce the auspices for the forthcoming vintage.
Correct, madam.
Except...
She turned to face her steward.
We have no grapes to lay on his altar as offerings.
Correct.
Because some clod on my estate came down with a sniffle, and the bailiff took it upon himself to quarantine the entire workforce.
To be fair, madam, the clod in question was the bailiff himself. He did not feel he could jeopardise the harvest by exposing...
Yes or no to the grapes?
Yes. No. I mean, yes, we have no...
So, in effect, I'm asking the King of the Immortals, God of Justice, God of Honour, God of Faith, to very kindly not drop a thunderbolt over my Etruscan vineyards, even though I haven't bothered to propitiate him this year.
The steward's Adam's apple jiggled up and down as his long, thin face crumpled like a piece of used papyrus.
That does appear to pretty much sum up the current situation, madam.
Oh, you think so, do you?
Claudia resumed her pacing of the atrium, wafting her fan so hard that a couple of the feathers sprang loose from their clip.
Dear Diana, it's hot. Small wonder that half of Rome has taken itself off to the cool of the country, or else to the seaside for the whole month of August.
She thought of the refreshing coastal breezes, a dip in the warm translucent ocean, the sound of cooling waves crashing against rocks.
Well, let me tell you something, Leonides. That doesn't sum up even half the current situation.
According to the astrologers and soothsayers in the forum, at least those diehards who hadn't fled this vile stinking heat, terrible storms were in the offing, unless almighty Jupiter could be appeased. For everyone else in the empire, storms would be a relief from this torpid, enervating swelter. Sweat soaked the workmen's tunics, plastering their hair to their foreheads. Meat turned in a day, and fish was best avoided unless it was flapping. Even the Tiber's waters ran yellow and sluggish, stinking to high heaven from refuse, sewage, and the carcasses of rotting sheep. But, for farmers with grapes still ripening on the vine, storms on the scale that were being predicted provoked only fear. A single hailstorm could wipe out their entire vintage.
Prayers and libations aren't enough.
Two more feathers flew out of the fan.
And I can hardly buy grapes from the market and palm them off to Jupiter as my own. It's enough that that bitch Fortune is quite unwavering on the subject of divine retribution at the moment. I don't want it spreading round Mount Olympus like a plague. And you're forgetting, Leonides, that I can't dispatch a slave to cut bunches until tomorrow at the earliest, because today is the festival of Diana, which just happens to be a holiday for slaves.
Oh, I hadn't forgotten.
Claudia blew a feather off the end of her nose.
At this rate, the wretched fan'll be bald by nightfall. And why the devil can't people make things to last any more? Surely that isn't too much to ask.
She stopped, turned, stared at her steward.
Very well, Leonides, you may go. Apart from my bodyguard, he's the only one left anyway. And it would take an earthquake, followed by a tidal wave, followed by every demon charging out of Hades, before Junius relinquishes his post.
She glanced across to where Junius was standing, feet apart, arms folded across his iron chest in the doorway to the vestibule.
For the life of me, I don't know why he isn't lavishing his hard-earned sesterces on garlands, girls and gaming tables like the rest of the men in my household. The girls, of course, have better things to do, dating back to some archaic ritual of washing hair, presumably in the days before fresh water had been piped into the city by a network of aqueducts. The festival of Diana is now just a wonderful excuse for slave women to gather by the goddess's temple on the Aventine. Continuing the theme of this ancient tradition, they spend the day pinning one another's hair in elaborate curls and experimenting with pins and coloured ribbons. And any other time I'd have been there too, watching dexterous fingers knotting, twisting, coiling, plaiting, because at least half a dozen innovative styles come out of this feast day on the Ides of August. Usually the shadows on the sundial on the temple wall fly past all too fast. But not today. Today I receive news that my bailiff's covered in spots, and rather than risk the harvest by having the workforce fall sick, he's put them in quarantine to the point where no one's even available to pick up a dozen clusters of grapes.
There was a grinding sound coming from somewhere. After a while, Claudia realised it was her teeth.
Junius!
Before she'd finished calling his name, he'd crossed the hall in three long strides. Was any bodyguard more dedicated, she wondered. Sometimes, catching sight of his piercing blue gaze trained upon her, she found his devotion to duty somewhat puzzling.
Any other chap and you'd think he carried a torch for me.
But come on, he was a slave. Claudia was his boss, and a young widow at that.
Widow, yes. With all the excitement, I'd almost forgotten my poor old husband. Yet the whole point of marrying someone older, fatter, and in the terminal stages of halitosis was for these vineyards, wasn't it? Well, not the vineyards exactly. I married him for what they were worth, although the bargain wasn't one-sided. He'd had what he wanted too, a pretty witty trophy wife, and one who was less than half his age at that. An arrangement that suited both of us, because by the time he finally broke through the ribbon of life's finishing line, his widow would be left in a very comfortable position. And you know it's worked out better than I hoped. Maybe not for him, being called across the River Styx a tad earlier than he'd expected, and certainly before he would have wished. And maybe not for his family either, who were written out of his will. But for me, life could not have turned out sweeter if I'd planned it. I inherited everything, from his vast spread of Etruscan vineyards to his commercial enterprises, from this fabulous house with its marbles and mosaics, right down to the contents of his bursting treasure chests. So why then didn't I sell up and walk away? It was how I'd envisaged my future after he died. No responsibilities, draw a line, start again. Instead, I haven't just hung on to the wine business, I seem to have taken an active, some might say, driving role. But that isn't the point. The point is I must remember to lay some flowers beside my husband's tomb sometime. And maybe I'll have his bust repainted this year too. It can't exactly be improving in the attic. Junius, I want you to run down to the Forum and hire a messenger. The ones by the Basilica are usually reliable, but if there's no one left today, and I'll be very surprised if there are, given that it's a holiday for slaves, try the place behind the record office.
Me? But I can't possibly leave you here alone, madam.
I promise that if a gang of murdering marauders come barging in, I'll ask them to wait until you're back to protect my honour, and in that way we can both get killed. How's that?
With respect, I don't consider danger a joking matter. These are the dog days of summer, madam. Men are driven mad by the appalling heat and by the sickness and disease that grips the city. With rich folk decamped to the country, only criminals and undertakers flourish in Rome at the moment.
Claudia nodded.
Very eloquently put, Junius. You are, of course, absolutely correct. And if you don't hurry, there won't be any messengers at the place behind the record office either.
But, madam...
It's a straight choice, Junius. Either you hire a courier to gallop like the wind to my estate, pick a dozen bunches of the ripest grapes, then ride straight back, where we might, just might, save the day, or I turn you into cash at the slave auction in the Forum in the morning.
The bodyguard drew himself up to his full height, squared his shoulders and clicked his heels together.
In that case, madam...
This time he didn't look at her, but stared straight ahead.
In that case, I have no alternative.
Excellent. Using the full services of the post-house and changing stations, the messenger can...
You will have to sell me in the morning.
What?
the remaining feathers sprayed out of her fan as Claudia crushed it in her fist.
This is not a debatable issue, Junius. You will...
I am not leaving you alone, and that is final.
Jupiter and Juno and Mars, that's all I bloody need. The only slave left on the entire premises turns out to be as stubborn as a stable full of mules.
She looked at the rigid line to his mouth, the square set to his chin, and resisted the urge to punch him on it.
Remind me of the position again. A storm threatens to wipe out this year's harvest. The offering to propitiate the god who threatens that storm isn't coming. There's no one available to go and fetch it, and the only person who could help is throwing tantrums.
In short, if she wanted a courier, Claudia would have to trek out in this ghastly, fly-blown, disease-ridden heat and hire one herself. A role her bodyguard would be very happy for her to undertake, because at least he could be on hand when robbers, thieves and rapists set upon them.
Is there anything else that bitch Fortune can throw in my path today?
The goddess's reply came almost at once. She delivered it in the form of a blood-curdling scream, which came from Claudia's very own garden. With its stately marble statues and rearing bronze horses, Claudia's garden was a testament to her late husband's wealth and social status. A red-tiled portico provided shade and offered shelter from the rain. The water from its terracotta gutters collected in oak butts to irrigate the vast array of herbs and flowers whose scent, in turn, fragranced the air throughout the year. Paved paths crisscrossed through clipped lavender and rosemary, while topiaried laurels and standard bay trees gave the garden depth and height. In the centre, a pool half covered by thick white waxy blooms of water lilies reflected sunshine, clouds or stars according to the weather. And all around, fountains splashed and chattered, making prisms as they danced, as well as an attractive proposition for birds in need of something more refreshing than a dust bath. That such a place of beauty and tranquillity could be shattered by such a scream was nothing short of outrage. The instant they heard it, Claudia and her bodyguard went flying down the atrium. From then, it was as though the sequence of events had been frozen. Time slowed. She might have been watching them unfold by following their progress on a carved relief. The screech had come from a young man scrambling down the fig tree which grew against the wall. Unlike her villa in the country, indeed like everybody's villa in the country, this house didn't have the room to follow the traditional pattern of four single-story wings from a central courtyard. For a start, it had two upper galleries for bedchambers and linen storage, each accessed by separate staircases, and a cellar which was accessed by steps outside the kitchens. The only possible site for a garden was behind the house and adjacent to its neighbours. With 1 million people crammed into the city, space was at a premium, and houses, even those of the wealthy, invariably butted up against each other. Claudia's was no exception. To the right, she adjoined with the house of a Syrian glass merchant, while her garden at the rear adjoined with General Volso's. Admittedly a loud-mouthed, drunken bully of a man. But all the same, it was from his premises that the youth was making his rather hurried exit. What he'd been up to in the general's house was clear from the array of golden goblets and silver platters which bulged out of the sack over his left shoulder. The contents nearly blinded her when the sunlight caught them. He was halfway down the fig tree when he let loose a second shriek.
"You!"
It took a moment before Claudia realised that they were not screams of alarm, but squeals of wild abandon.
Yeah!
The grin on his face as he jumped down was as wide as a barn.
"Hey! You stop right there!"
The boy spun round in surprise, but didn't falter as he belted towards the wicker gate on the far side of the garden.
"Stop!"
This was a different voice, a soldier's bark.
"Stop, or I'll shoot!"
Junius was already racing down the path to cut off the thief's escape, so he didn't bother looking round to see who was shouting from the top of the neighbour's wall. Claudia did. It was Labio, one of the general's henchmen and a retired captain of archers. The thief had used a ladder to make good his escape. His mistake lay in not kicking it away, and Labio had shinned up it like a monkey. The boy shot a quick glance at the bodyguard charging down the path towards him. Halfway to the gate, he knew he could outsprint him. Claudia knew it too, and so did Labbio. On a public holiday, the street outside would be heaving. One more thief, lost in a crowd.
"Last chance or I'll fire!"
Claudia saw the grin drop from the boy's face, realised that he hadn't noticed Labbio till now, thought it was a bluff being called by someone from inside Claudia's house, not from the top of the wall. He turned, saw the archer, dropped the sack.
All right, you can have it!"
Gold, bronze, copper and silver spilled over the pinks and the lilies. Ivory figurines knocked the heads off the roses. What happened next would stay with Claudia for the rest of her life. Watching the cascade of precious artifacts, she first saw its reflection in the pool. An arc of white flying left to right. Heard a soft hiss, looked up. The arrow hit the boy in the centre of his back. She heard the splinter of bone, the soft yelp that sprang from his lips. For 3 paces he did not stop running. Then his arms splayed, his legs buckled. Red froth burst from his mouth. Still he kept on going. It was only when he reached the gate and tried to unbar it that he realised he couldn't make it. Junius had caught up by now, was cradling the boy in his lap. Claudia could hear him whispering soft words of comfort as she flew to his side.
"Shh, lad."
Junius wiped the fringe from the boy's face and patted his cheek.
"It's all right. There's a physician on the way."
His expression was haunted as it met Claudia's unvoiced question.
"You don't understand."
The boy's head rolled wildly and his breath bubbled red.
"You're not supposed to be like this."
Terrified eyes bored into Claudia's. She could see that they were brown, brown as an otter.
"I'm not going to die, am I?"
"Of course not,"
she said, only there was something wrong with her eyes, because her vision was misty.
"It's just a wound, like Junius says. You'll be back on your feet in a week."
But that wasn't quite true. The otter was already swimming the Styx. For his part, Labbio had no sympathy for what he termed a dead piece of scum. Indeed, he would have pulled the arrow out of the boy's back to see how the head had compacted upon impact, had he not been prevented by Mistress Snotty from next door slapping his hand away.
"Bitch. Shooting glares at me, like it's my bloody fault. But what did she expect me to do? Let the thieving tow-rag go? The General's instructions have always been to shoot intruders, whether they're on the premises or in the process of escaping, and it doesn't matter to me whether this piece of filth was carrying a dagger or not,"
he added coldly, when taken to task about killing an unarmed, defenceless boy.
"He was guilty, and the proof, if it's necessary, lies all over your flowerbeds, ma'am. I'm not accountable to her, the little bitch. But damn it, she just won't let it rest, will she? On and on about how young he is, and hadn't anybody stopped to consider what drove the poor lad to resort to stealing, because she could see he wasn't used to it. And no one in their right mind would run off up a busy street with a sack full of golden objects and not have the army after them. And anyway, what seasoned professional would go round leaving ladders against walls to make life easy for his pursuers? Fine. If she wants to feel sorry for that little turd, go right ahead. But I'm behind the General all the way on this. Let criminals think you're a soft touch, and every bloody thief will be climbing up the balcony. So, she can rant all she likes. I'm doing what I'm paid to do, and that arrow went exactly where I'd aimed it."
"Labbio!"
Quite at what point that silly cow next door intended to shut up, Labbio didn't know. But he was mighty glad when he heard the General call his name from the far side of the wall. The master wasn't actually expected back for hours, but wouldn't he be pleased to hear his captain had bagged a sewer rat this morning.
"Labbio!"
Except there was something different about the General's bellow. Every bit as terse, nothing unusual about that, and no less urgent either. The General was not a patient man, but... well, it just sounded different, that was all.
"Over here, General. Caught a burglar stealing your gold. Shot him as he escaped."
Is he dead?
Volso was scaling the ladder two steps at a time. He was a tall man, in maybe his 42nd summer, broad of shoulder and square of jaw, his skin weathered from years of campaigning and thickened from too many nights cradling the wine jar. But he cut a commanding enough figure on and off the field, and regular training in the gymnasium had clearly paid off. It was a lean and nimble figure that swung itself over the adjoining wall.
Couldn't be deader, sir.
Pity.
Volso dropped to the ground and marched over to where Junius and Claudia were conversing quietly over the body, and rammed his foot into the corpse.
Bastard didn't deserve an easy death.
Volso!
Claudia stepped in front before he could land a second kick.
You are on my property, General, and I'll thank you to have some respect for it, for me, and the dead.
Respect? Respect?
He pushed her aside and slammed his boot into the boy's side as he had intended.
Save your sympathy, Claudia. If Labio hadn't killed him, public execution certainly would.
Stealing is a civil matter.
Stealing is?
The General nodded.
But murder isn't. That boy you're so protective of didn't just rob me of my gold and silver, he robbed me of my wife.
Volso turned to face his archer.
Callista's body is still sprawled across the bedroom floor where this bastard strangled her.
Moonlight had turned the garden paths to silver. The feathery leaves of artemisia and the pale purple flowers of sweet rocket released musky perfume into heat that pulsated like a cricket, and mice rustled beneath the fan-trained peach trees, pears and apricots. Bats squeaked on the wing in search of moths. An owl hooted from the cedar three doors down, and a frog plopped gently into the pool from a water lily leaf. The slaves were not back yet. Milking their precious holiday for all it was worth, there was none of the customary clattering of pots and skillets from the kitchens. No bickering coming out of the married quarters. The heather brooms and garden shears were silent. Everything was silent. Seated on a white marble bench with her back against an apple tree, Claudia watched her blue-eyed, cross-eyed, dark Egyptian cat chase a mouse round the shrine in the corner of the garden, and slowly sipped her wine. The wine was dark, dark as Claudia's mood, and every bit as heavy. Cradling the green glass goblet in both hands, she stared up at the night sky without blinking.
The stars will make life easy for navigation out at sea tonight.
Directly overhead, the dragon roared and Hercules strode purposefully across the heavens, wielding his olive wood club.
How very appropriate that it's the constellation of Sagittarius rising over the southern horizon. Sagittarius the archer.
The army had come, conducted its investigation in the twinkling of an eye and departed hours ago. The young man's body had been unceremoniously carted away on a stretcher, and Labio had been lauded for a job well done, both by the army and his bereaved employer. It had been left to Claudia and her bodyguard to stack the stolen objects back inside the sack where Junius later returned them to their owner. Still staring at the stars, she sipped her wine.
So then.
A tall patrician body eased itself onto the bench, leaned its back against the rough bark of the apple tree, and crossed its long patrician legs at its booted ankles.
Cut and dried.
Even above the scents of the junipers and cypress, the heliotrope and the lilies, she could smell his spicy sandalwood unguent, caught a faint whiff of the rosemary in which his trademark long linen tunic had been rinsed.
I wondered how long it would take before Marcus Cornelius arrived on the scene.
Claudia topped up her goblet from the jar.
Damn it! I can't make a single move without the security police popping up in the form of their only aristocratic investigator, who seems to view my, let's call them misdemeanours, as his fast track to the Senate. Still, what do I care? I have nothing to hide from him this time. For once, Marcus Cornelius is whistling in the dark.
She couldn't see him, but knew he was grinning.
Why, were you running a book on when I'd arrive?
You should know that gambling's against the law, Marcus.
which happens to be one of the reasons I've called round.
A shower of bronze betting receipts scattered on the path.
Yours, I believe.
Never seen them before in my life. Bugger! That was the best boxer in Rome I'd backed with those.
Well, what about these, then?
A dozen more bronze pieces showered down, and that, unless she'd missed her guess, was what she'd invested 5-1 on a Scythian wrestler from the north coast of the Black Sea.
Bugger, bugger, bugger!
We caught the bookie touting outside the Imperial Palace. You know, you really should be more careful who you have dealings with, Claudia.
She skewered him with a glare.
Damn right.
How much of your husband's money do you have left?
The old adage is true. The best way to make a small fortune is to start with a large one.
Jupiter alone knows what will happen to the family fortune once I'm married to you. We'll probably be celebrating our 5th anniversary in the gutter.
She supposed it was the moon making twinkles in his eyes, but in its clear 3/4 light, she could see every curl in his thick mop of hair, the solid musculature of his chest, the crisp, dark hairs on the back of his forearm.
I would go to the lions before I went to the altar with you, Marcus Cornelius. And if you finished littering my garden path with metal, perhaps you'd be kind enough to sod off. I have a pressing engagement.
She patted the wine jar beside her.
With my friend Bacchus here.
He folded his hands behind his head and closed his eyes.
You seem to have a lot of metal littering your garden path all of a sudden. Tell me about this morning.
No. Why the hell does he think I want to get drunk? To forget, that's why. To forget a young man with an ecstatic grin and eyes as brown as an otter. Eyes that I watched glaze in death.
Marcus recrossed his ankles, but did not open his eyes.
There's more to it than that, Claudia. I know you inside out. Tell me.
If I did, you wouldn't believe me.
I don't believe you've never seen these betting slips. I don't believe you've never defrauded your customers. And I don't believe you've never smuggled your wine out of Rome to avoid paying taxes. That's why I love you, my darling. And that's why I know that when you marry me, life will never be dull.
See a physician, you have a fever.
Just as I know that I'll never be able to trust you with money or business, but I do trust your judgment, Claudius Aferius. What is it about this morning that bothers you?
You really want to know?
Claudia drew a deep breath, stared up at the celestial archer, let her breath out slowly, to a count of 5.
What bothers me, Marcus, is that a woman was murdered today and the wrong man took the blame. A young man who conveniently is not around to tell his side of the story.
You think Labia?
That arrogant oaf!
In her mind she heard again the sickening thud as the general's boot thudded into the dead boy's ribs, heard the youth's exuberant yell as he scrambled down the fig tree on the wall.
No, Marcus, Labio did not kill Callista.
She thought of her tiny, fair-haired neighbour, laid out on her funeral bier in Volso's atrium. Cypress at the door, torches burning at her feet.
Volso is a domineering drunk and a bully who liked to beat his wife and children. Juno in heaven, how often did I hear them? The muffled screams, the pleading, racking sobs that lasted well into the night. How many times did I rush round there, only for the door to be slammed in my face? And the next day Callista's story was always the same. The children had fallen downstairs, she'd walked into a pillar. Sweet Janus, how many times did I beg her to leave the vicious brute? One day, Callista, he'll end up killing one of the children, I said. You need to think of them, if not yourself. But months passed and nothing changed until, miracle of miracles, Callista called round last week to confide that she was leaving. Enough was enough, she said, you're right. One of these days Volso will go too far. As soon as she found suitable accommodation for herself and the children, Callista said, she would pack her bags and leave.
So you think Volso killed his wife?
No, Marcus. I killed her. I could easily have taken Callista and the children in, but I was too busy placing bets on boxers and wrestlers, ordering new gowns for the festival, planning parties, organising dinners, garlanding the hall with floral tributes. A battered wife with moping children would have got in the way and put a dampener on everyone's spirits. As surely as Volso throttled the life out of poor Callista, so I provided him with the ammunition.
Marcus was forced to admit that when Claudia told him he wouldn't believe her, he was wrong. That Volso killed his wife he could accept. The minute he'd heard that Callista had been found strangled in the course of a burglary, his suspicions were aroused. Having listened to the report of the centurion sent to investigate the killing of the thief, he'd not been at all satisfied with the army's neat conclusion. Volso's reputation preceded him, and Marcus knew him as the type who firmly believed his wife and children were his property, that he would say who came and who went, and that nobody but nobody left him unless he threw them out. That was why he'd called on Claudia this evening, to hear her view on the matter. But that she was morally responsible was bullshit. In time, of course, Claudia would come to see this for herself, and Marcus knew the quickest way for her to reach this point was for her to help him clap the cold-blooded bastard in irons.
The killing required a lot of planning.
And together, as the archer rose and the level in the wine jug sank, they pieced together the sequence of events. First, having made her decision, Callista must have somehow given the game away. Perhaps she had started to pack things in a chest. Maybe she'd confided to one of the older children. Who knows? Hell, she might even have lodged her claim in a divorce court, where Volso was just powerful enough to have the scribe report the matter back. Either way, he somehow knew about her plan, but did not let on. Instead, he went out and hired himself a thief. As a military man, he'd know exactly where to look. And, as a commander of long standing, he would know what type of character to choose. Someone gullible for a start. Someone who would believe the story he had spun them about having fallen on hard times and how the debt collectors would be knocking at his door any day now to seize his assets. But if he could beat them at their own game, if he could stage a burglary, for instance, whereby the thief was paid handsomely to steal the goods, which he would then hand over to the general's henchmen outside in the street to be converted into liquid assets, which the debt collectors would never know about.
How do you know he told the boy there would be an accomplice?
The yells. The yells were to alert the person he believed would be loitering in the street outside my garden gate, ready to relieve him of the sack and pay whatever ridiculous sum Volso had promised him. Like I said, he needed someone gullible.
Older, more experienced thieves would not have swallowed the bait. This boy had to be new at the game. No one else would have been told to leave the ladder against the wall, then actually left it there.
Except his yells alerted Labio, who would have been primed by Volso that on a slave's holiday, the house might well be a target for thieves, and remind him that he was to shoot on sight.
All right, perhaps it wasn't Labio's fault after all. He'd been as much a pawn in the game as the boy. The one lured by greed, the other by pride. The difference, of course, being that Labio was alive.
So,
Marcus steepled his fingers.
The house is empty because the slaves are out celebrating. It's just Labio and Callista, who Volso had undoubtedly drugged. The thief sneaks in, probably through your garden, shins up the fig tree and over the wall, then places the ladder so he can make his escape. Inside the house, he fills the sacks with the items he's been instructed to pick, and then, when he's finished, he screams like a banshee because it's vital the accomplice is outside for a quick handover.
The yells, of course, alert Labio, who finds no trouble chasing him thanks to the ladder Volso thought to set in place.
She could see why he'd made general. In military tactics, timing is crucial.
Because while we're all nicely diverted by the robbery and the killing, the master of the house is free to walk in through his own front door and throttle Callista at his leisure.
Marcus plucked a blade of grass and chewed it.
Well now, that's when it starts to get tricky. You see, Volso refused point blank to give his porter the day off, and the porter is adamant his master left the house shortly after dawn and did not come back until after the boy had been shot. He knows this because when Volso came home, the porter immediately told him about the robbery and was with him when he found Callista's body.
He paused, cracked his knuckles, spiked his hands through his hair in frustration.
Therefore, Volso could not have killed his wife.
Dawn was painting the sky a dusky heather pink when Claudia finally stood up. The first blackbird had started to sing from the cherry tree. Mice made last-minute searches for beetles, and frogs began to croak from the margins of the lily pond. She shook the creases from her pale blue linen gown, smoothed pleats which had wilted in the heat, and forced half a dozen wayward ringlets back into their ivory comb. The first of the slaves had begun to trickle home 3 hours ago. Gradually the rest had staggered in, singing, belching, giggling under their breath, their footsteps and their voices restoring order to the silent house. Without their presence, it was as though the bricks and mortar had been in hibernation. Now it was a home again, for them as well as Claudia, the rafters resonating with their drunken squabbles and their laughter, the clang of a kicked pan here, the spluttered expletive from a banged shin there, the bawling of too many overtired children. For most of the night, she and Marcus had sat in silence in the moonlight, trying to figure out how Volso could have done it. Twice Marcus got up to fill the wine jar and fetch cheese, dates and small cakes made from candied fruit, spices and honey to help mop up the booze. But now, as dawn poked her head above the corners of the eastern horizon, the security policeman admitted defeat.
So he's got away with it, hasn't he?
There was a shadow of stubble around his chin, she noticed, and lines round his eyes, which didn't come from lack of sleep.
The cold, conniving bastard's going to walk.
Claudia stretched, massaged the back of her neck, and smiled.
You fetch the army and arrest him, Marcus. I'll give you the proof.
She glanced across at the garden wall, then back at her own house.
Gotcha, you son of a bitch.
It started in the garden. It was fitting it should end there, she supposed. By the time the legionaries came clunking in, their greaves and breastplates shining in the sun, Claudia had changed into a gown of the palest turquoise blue and was seated in the shade of the portico beside the fountain taking breakfast. In her hand was a letter from her bailiff, and the news was good. The spots were not contagious, he had written. According to the estate's horse doctor, they were the result of eating tunny fish. The grapes for Jupiter were on their way.
I should bloody well hope so, too. Caught up in yesterday's tragedy, I'd completely forgotten about sending a courier to fetch them. And maybe I'll call in at Fortune's Temple in the cattle market later to drop off a trinket or two. Fickle bitch, but not so bad when you boil it down.
You'll pay for this.
Volso struggled as the soldiers dragged him down the path.
By Hades, I have you in court for slander, Claudia, and I'll take every penny you own in damages. This house, the vineyards, ah, the bloody lot. You'll be so poor you won't be able to afford the sewerage from my gutter.
Save it for the lions, Volso.
She bit into a peach, and the juice dribbled down her chin.
You planned Callista's murder like a military campaign and thought you'd got away with it.
She mopped the juice up with a cloth.
Only there were three people you underestimated.
Come on, then. Let's hear this crackpot theory. It will make for interesting evidence at your slander trial.
Behind the group, she watched Marcus Cornelius let the bronze statue of a horse absorb his weight. He hadn't had time to change his tunic, yet she swore that, above the smell of soldiers' sweat, the leathery scent emanating from Volso, and the pungent perfumes of the herbs in the flower beds, basil, thyme and majoram, she could detect a hint of sandalwood. An expression had settled on his face as he watched her, which, with anyone else, she would have interpreted as pride.
Firstly, Volso, you underestimated the boy. He was young, keen, gullible, vulnerable, in fact all the things you'd wanted him to be, and that was the problem. He was too young, too keen, too gullible.
He ought to have picked someone who was greedy, not needy. The screams gave it away. Yes, he'd yelled as he'd been instructed, but the shrieks he'd let out were wild and exuberant, whoops of pure joy. I've done it, they said. I've got away with the stash. The accomplice is outside, and I'm going to be rich. She remembered the grin as wide as a barn, the dancing light of triumph in his eyes. That was not the expression of a thief who'd just strangled a woman in a burglary that had gone horribly wrong.
Secondly, you underestimated my steward.
Volso might run a tight ship next door, checking for specks of dust and fingerprints on statues, taking the whip to his wife and his slaves if he found so much as one thing out of order. What he'd overlooked is that not everyone gets off on that level of control. It might work on the battlefield, but Claudia's slaves wouldn't know what a whip looked like, for God's sake. And Leonides wasn't the type of steward to have his crew running around doing unnecessary tasks. The cellar was cleaned thoroughly, but only twice a year, and that was twice as often as any public temple. She turned to Marcus.
Marcus, did you find the substances I listed?
I certainly did. We found traces on his boots and tunic from where he'd bumbled around in your cellar in the dark while he counted out the timing. Flour from the grinding wheel, cinnamon where it had spilled out of the sack, a vinegar stain, a smear of pitch. The corporal has the full list.
You planted that, you bastard.
We didn't plant your boot prints in the dust. The impression from a shoe is almost non-existent unless there's a body inside it to make tracks.
But the general wasn't going down without a fight.
The fact that I was in her cellar proves nothing. In fact, I remember now. 2 or 3 days ago, I called round to borrow some charcoals. As a run out.
Even the legionaries couldn't stop sniggering. General Volso running next door to borrow coal. Jupiter would turn celibate first. Volso turned back to Claudia.
And the third person I suppose have underestimated? That's you, I imagine.
Good heavens, no.
Claudia shot him a radiant smile.
My dear Volso, that was your wife.
Apart from the fact that frogs would grow wings before Volso came home early to check on a wife who had not been feeling well, had he not left Callista's body sprawled on the bedroom floor, he might still have talked his way out of it. But what devoted husband wouldn't lift his beloved onto the bed? Only a callous bastard of the highest order would think of leaving her in an ignominious and distorted heap for people to gawp at. In death, Callista had the last word after all. The legionaries were gone, their prisoner with them. The tranquillity of the garden had returned, and there was no indication among the rose arbours and herbiaries of the tragedy that had taken place here. Not just one death either, but three, Callista's, the boy's, and Volso's to come in the arena. He planned the two murders like a military campaign. Coldly and ruthlessly, he chose the day when slaves everywhere, not just his own, would be out. No doubt he'd expected his neighbour to be out too, as she usually was on the Festival of Diana, but it wouldn't matter unduly. He would climb into Claudia's garden using the ladder, then kick it away after him. He would hide in the cellar, biding his time until he heard screams, and then whoever might have been in the house would certainly rush outside. He would give it a count of 20 before leaving the cellar, but then comes the daring part. He actually walks across the garden while everyone is clustered around the thief's body. If challenged, of course, he can bluff it out by claiming he'd heard a scream as he was returning home and rushed to help. Then he would just nip over the garden wall to check on his wife, only to report back that she was dead. As it happened, no one saw him. Up and over, throttle the missus, up and back again in no time, before calmly letting himself out of Claudia's house and sauntering up to his own, whistling without a care in the world as the porter had testified. And now they were gone, all of them. Volso, Callista, the otter.
Do you think we'll ever know the boy's name?
Marcus pursed his lips and shrugged.
Doubt it. Urchins like him disappear every day.
It was the unseen tragedy of the big city and so-called civilization. Across the garden, a chink of gold reflected from beneath the mint, a small child's goblet with a double handle. And so the tragedy goes on, Claudia thought. She looked up into Marcus's eyes, resisted the urge to brush that stupid fringe from where it had fallen down over his face and trace her finger down the worry lines round his eyes.
I was standing here, you know, when I saw the reflection of that arrow in the pool.
Here?
Right here.
She pointed to the spot with a determined finger. Sweet Jupiter in heaven, she'd never forget it.
White as snow, I watched it arc through the air.
Marcus scratched his ear.
Not from there, you didn't. If Labia was standing on the ladder and the boy was near the gate, and if he kept on running, like you said, after he'd been hit, then the arrow travelled like so.
He indicated the trajectory of the missile with his hands.
As you can see, the path doesn't curve as you describe it. Also, the arrow wasn't white, it's almost black, and Labio's is far longer than the one you saw reflected in the water. What's more, if it was travelling at the speed, angle and direction that you say, it would be you that was lying dead, not your little otter. Oh, and by the way, did I ever tell you you're stunning when you're angry? And you're stunning when you're not. And you're even more stunning when you're breaking generals' balls. Yes, I think a spring wedding would be rather fun, don't you?
I'd marry an arena full of Volsos before I married you. But what I don't understand is this. If it wasn't Labio's arrow that I saw reflected in the pool, what was it?
Marcus thought of the suffocating heat that played strange tricks by bending light. He thought of the emotion of the moment, the reflection of a white dove overhead. In fact, he could think of any number of rational explanations. But then, there was also the matter of a certain mischievous little cherub by the name of Cupid. So he said nothing. He just pulled Claudia into his arms and kissed her.
Cupid's Arrow is copyrighted by Marilyn Todd. Heard in the cast of this dramatized reading were Mandy Davis as narrator, Marilyn Todd as Claudia, Bill Gilliam as Captain of Archers, India Mouse as the Thief, Martin Woodrow as General Volso, Chris Davis as Marcus Cornelius, Kevin Todd as Leonides the Steward, and Andrew Sutherland as Junius the Bodyguard. Music for this podcast was taken from the fourth movement of Johann Sebastian Bach's Lute Suite No. 2 in C minor, performed by Martha Goldstein. Mixing for this podcast was done by Emily Giuliarano. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/eqmm.